There are billions and billions of transactions going through the bank in any one time. And these transactions, as they come in and they come out, go through a number of different silos, whether it be anti-money laundering or fraud or domestic, international, whatever it might be. And as much as the banks don't want to say this, they often, these transactions get lost or they get stuck for various reasons. Sometimes silos don't speak to each other, whatever it might be. So Intix is a data platform. It's a data layer that essentially takes all the transactions and puts them into one place. A, you can find them. And B, you can put alerts in. For example, a transaction is any longer than 30 seconds in anti-money laundering and it gets stuck, you gotta stop.
Welcome back to Purpose Driven FinTech Podcast. I am your host, Moni Millares. In today's episode, I speak with Tina Fisher, Chief Marketing Officer at Intix. Tina shares with us how we can 10 times the impact we have as fintechers and we go deep on the world of trust. Tina has an impressive trajectory. She was named top female tech founder by the British government and her company Snapsafe was listed as top 12 Series A investment opportunity by VC4A. We tap into her mind and heart and she shares her top advice for women wanting to grow their business and career. And as part of International Women's Month, we deep dive on how we as an industry can invest more in women. Lastly, in today's world, data is king. Data empowers so many propositions and operations. Hence, it's important we become data savvy. We discuss how Intix helps organizations consolidate transaction data for improved efficiency and enhance better customer experience, reduce costs, and the power of their unique value proposition. If you enjoyed this pod, please subscribe, follow, and leave a 5-star rating. Tina, welcome to the show. Thank you for your time.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. So let's go straight into it. So this podcast is all about how we can build better fintechs and have more impact. So we ask questions like, hey, how can we add more value to customers? Hey, how can technology help us to add more value? In this case, that's a very relevant question. But before we go into the detail as such, I'd like to start with, how can we design and build more purpose-driven fintechs?
Wow, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yes.
I think it's about solving problems. So what problems are in the world and how can we solve them? I've lived and worked for a very long time in Africa, and there the problems are very different than they are, let's say, in other parts of the world. Very few people have bank accounts. They're very expensive. Cash is king. And so there's not only the crime involved in having large amounts of cash, about how do you move cash around different countries and that kind of thing. And then in Europe or the UK, obviously, the issues around finances are very different. How do you make your money work for you? It's about financial education, empowering people. Very different needs and very different, basically, values that people need from fintechs out there. So I think it's about finding the need and helping solve problems, whatever they might be and wherever they might be.
Yes. And that's a very good point. I love that you start with such a good point that it's geography does matter.
Yeah,
we have Africa is different to Asia, that is different to Europe, which then leads me to this point that this is like what I keep thinking about, which is at fintech as an industry, we started 10 years ago or so with the idea of having impact, of helping people with financial stress. And as much impact and progress that we've had in the past 10 years, and now there's fintechs everywhere, I don't think that we've had massive impact, especially because like financial stress continues to be one of the top sources of stress for people. And given where we are with macroeconomics and inflation, like people feel the stress even more. So the question that runs in my mind is, if we continue doing what we're doing today, we'll continue to have incremental impact in people's lives. So what do we need to think about today so that then we can have 5 times or 10 times the impact and really have impact in people's lives in their lifetime? Let's say people in Africa, in their lifetime, what do we need to be thinking about today so that then we can accelerate that impact?
I think it boils down to trust and scale. And why I say trust number one is I have been in the DRC, the Republic of Congo, in a township where there's literally a guy in a plastic table with lots of cash. They work in three different currencies in the country, and you come along with one currency and the guy will give it. And then I was working for a fintech that would help people take their cash and transfer it to another location, to another country, another location. And there's a lot of distrust around this system, because what if I give you my money and someone takes it? The understanding around that. And I would say that also happens in Europe or anything. Before, let's say, Apple Pay and Google Pay came along, could you imagine just having your card details in your phone and thinking that was safe and someone could come along and scam them, or you're touching and tapping? Remember, tap came out, everybody thought, okay, anything under 200. So it's trust. And why I say scale is that I think of Uber as a really good example. 10, 15 years ago, can you imagine getting into a random car with a driver you didn't know? But scale now to Uber is a verb. It's something people do. The safety measures along it. So there's always some issues. But my point is, in a grand scheme of things, as a woman getting into a car, knowing the driver, knowing his rating, knowing his details in advance, I trust the system. And so if you go back to fintechs, I think, again, there's geography, but ultimately it's trust and scale. So trust we need to build in terms of how we're going to, that people's money is safe, and then scale that actually this is going to help. So like the tapping, and that now has become part of our everyday lives. And I think until that happens, it's going to be really difficult to have the type of impact that we want on people's lives.
That's very interesting, because it's going back to the roots.
Everything is trust. I think there's a reason why the large retailers are still around, because people trust them. Yes, they might be able to get their goods cheaper, but websites these days, they can be skinned. They are could be fraudulent and all that kind of thing. But if you're shopping at Tesco and John Lewis, or from a UK perspective, or Carrefour from a European perspective, you're going to get, and you can trust the brand. So I think a lot of it has to come down to that.
Definitely. And then just to build on this, let's say we manage to nail down the trust barrier and scale, and we're like, yes, we had impact. We had 5 times, 10 times the impact, especially as a data person. When we look in the future and we say, hey, not as an individual fintech, but as an industry, how could we measure this impact?
Again, so I'm just breaking it down. You talk about consumers' uptake, the amount of dollars, euros, whatever in the system that has changed. I think if somebody refers to your organization as a verb, I think that's a pretty good indication that you've made an impact. I think from a professional perspective, or B2B perspective, in the organization that I'm in now, works with a lot of tier one and tier two global banks. And I think that there is still a lot of hesitation to adopt fintechs within their system. There's still a reliance upon building it internally. And I think that actually there's something to be said about going to an expert that is all that they do. And again, it's that trust about someone else might do something, have been more expertise than you will. I think it circles around to that as well.
Interesting. So coming back to you and to Intix as such, you have a very intriguing tagline in the website that is because it's intriguing. It's intelligent insights, smarter decisions, gain a complete view of real-time transaction data on one platform. What does that mean?
Darren, so describe a little bit to what the problem that we're solving and the solution, and then that can give you an insight. If Ugeo was a tier one bank, there are billions and billions of transactions going through the bank in any one time. And these transactions, as they come in and they come out, go through a number of different silos, whether it be anti-money laundering or fraud or domestic, international, whatever it might be. And as much as the banks don't want to say this, these transactions get lost or they get stuck for various reasons. sometimes silos don't speak to each other, whatever it might be. So Intix is a data platform. It's a data layer that essentially takes all the transactions and puts them into one place. A, you can find them. And B, you can put alerts in. For example, a transaction is any longer than 30 seconds in anti-money laundering and it gets stuck, you get a flag. So think of Google is exactly pretty much the same technology. It's an indexing technology. Technically, you're not actually accessing every single web page in the world. It's just indexing. If you type something in, you can find what you're looking for. It's the same type of thing. You type in your name, for example, the value or the country that you've been sending it from, and then you can find that actual transaction. So by being able to have that, goes back to the tagline. So all the transactions in one place, which you'd think is something that is easily done, but it's really not because they're different formats, they're different systems, they're 20-year-old, they're 2-year-old systems, they don't talk to each other, so it brings it all in one place. It's a single window for all your transactions. And then the fact that if you have all your transactions in one place, you're able then to analyze what's working and what's not working from an operational perspective. So before I was saying, okay, your transactions might get stuck in anti-money laundering for more than 30 seconds. From an operational perspective, that's an issue because you have customers calling you up and saying, okay, where's my payment? Could be reputational damage. Tier one bank loses £1 million transaction, that kind of a thing. And then you have all the data so that you can see where your transactions are. Are they flowing? My customer call care center has gone down by 80% or what it might be. So that by having the data and then analyzing it allows you to make better decisions. So the fact that now I can see that my customer care queries have gone down, or I can see that my liquidity has gone up because I have everything in one place, I can then monitor. So that's where the tagline comes from.
Yeah. And that explains a lot behind the context, behind the tagline, which then it's, I have a better understanding and I have a hypothesis, but I'll ask you anyways. What is the hypothesis of Intix as such that they were like, hey, this is our business hypothesis and we're here to win? What was the thing going on through people's minds?
So the founders started this about 11 or 12 years ago, and they both worked at Swift. And they were basically a huge organization specializing in transferring money internationally. And what they noticed was that Swift has one particular format of international payment, but there are many out there. And the banks were getting these payments and getting the messages and the transactions, because there's a lot of information that comes through from a message. So it's the person's name, the country, the currency, the all these different kinds of things, but they weren't storing it anywhere. And so I would say it's almost like they saw a gap in the market because they were involved in the organization and they were involved with the banks, that they saw actually there's no data layer to actually capture all of this information. So I suppose like anything, it's about finding a problem and then solving it. And sometimes a very niche problem, if you solve it and you solve it, it then becomes successful.
Yes. And you know what? You're not the first person that says that in the podcast. It's more of a, hey, find the niche problem and then be the best in solving that problem. That's it.
Exactly.
And then it makes you a very successful fintech / company.
Exactly.
Cool.
Exactly.
So before we go deeper into Intix as such, because it's a fascinating topic as such, data. But given that it's International Women's Month and you have an amazing trajectory, I want to talk about you first. Usually I never talk about the guest first, but I'm like, no, Tina, she has a great trajectory. Okay. Cool. So when I say that you have a great trajectory, just for everyone to know what we mean, basically you were named top female tech founder by the British government and your company SnapSave was listed as top 12 Series A investment opportunity by VC4A.
Yes.
So yes, well done first.
Thank
well
you.
Done. Building a business is not easy. In general, like life is not easy. There's many women, whether we're building a career or building a business, building a family, or a mix of the three for some of them. What's your top advice for women wanting to grow their business? Even if it's not a VC business, it's just their business.
So this is a subject of which I'm very passionate about, women in tech. And I've done a lot of speaking engagement. I've mentored young women trying to get into the sector. I am often the only woman in the room. And that has to change. And has to change. But it's going to take, and as just a sidestep to the question, it's going to take longer to change because the systems are set up, are not necessarily set up for women in the workplace, whether we like it or not, whether we have supportive partners, which I absolutely do, whether if you have children or if you have other responsibilities, oftentimes we carry this burden in it. And the way that the workplace is set up and sitting in an office and 9 to 5, it doesn't always allow that flexibility from a growing a business perspective. So snap and say, just for everyone out there, as a business that's in Southern Africa and it's a B2B2C. So on one side, you have FMCG companies, P&G, Unilever, Pepsi, Coke of the world. And on the other side, you hear consumers. And it's a way for these brands to talk to and to influence consumer shopping habits and taking the retailer out of it. And they do that by offering discounts and coupons and things like that. So everybody wins. Consumers get money back for their shopping. Brands get their sales uplift and everybody's happy. What was really difficult was working with DCs and who were all men. Again, I was the only person in the room. My co-founder was a man. And convincing them of the market need for something like this, because they couldn't put themselves in, they couldn't picture themselves as the consumer who would use something like this. 67 to 70% of our users are women, because traditionally they still make the purchasing decisions. And a lot of them were with families because actually getting 50 cents or whatever it might be off a loaf of bread and all the other things, and it goes up to electric toothbrushes, is significant because it grows your cash at the end of the day and your purchasing power. And they couldn't picture themselves needing something like that because, of course, they don't make the purchasing decisions. They aren't economically in that bracket. And so it was very difficult to get the funding in the first place. And I think that there has to be, whether there are more female-led funds or whether there's a broadening of understanding of the target market, for example, of who we're trying to serve. I gave them all the statistics in the world, but it really, at the end of the day, there's a personal bias.
Yeah.
So I think that as a woman growing a business, it's tough to be tenacious. You have to work twice as hard. You have to, it's unfortunate, and I don't like saying it, but you do. And here we are in Women's Month, and I think it's still really something that we need to discuss. We really need to talk about and get the word out there of how we've come a long way, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah. It's so interesting because about a year ago, maybe less, I had a guest in the podcast. She is a unicorn by now in Brazil. And when I asked her similar, was like, what was the secret to success? And she was like, I always work harder than anyone else. And I was like,
it's really unfortunate. I remember my co-founder. He was really good about it. We'd be sitting in board meetings or investor pitches, and I would be saying something, and no one, it would resonate, and he would literally then repeat it, what I said, and everybody would think it was a great idea. And he knew what he was doing. He was doing it on purpose because that he wanted everyone to hear it, but it didn't resonate. So yeah, until things like that change, and it doesn't have to be even growing a business. It could be in the corporate world. It could be corporate policies. It could be flexible working environments that after COVID, people mandated going back into the offices, where for women, people of color, socioeconomic disadvantaged people who have childcare issues, that becomes a real problem. And it's not about their commitment to their work. it's really circumstances. And I think now with technology, we should be flexible. We need to be flexible. And actually, if you provide a sense of culture and trust, again, in your employees, I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, because then...
Like I said, I'm passionate about this topic. But anyway, a
whole hour of that.
Yeah,
I could.
Just to add to that. So this year, the theme is investing women for International Women's Month. What's your take on how can we invest in women practically?
I think it's all levels of this social sphere, if you will. You know, obviously having lived in Africa a long time, there's a big push on empowering women in female-led households because the majority of women are single parents. And so teaching them skills to smart start small businesses and all that kind of thing so that they can feed their families and be self-sufficient, all the way up to representation in boardrooms in other countries, having finances for, I'll give the example of my business, which was more of a female-focused business, and getting funding for those. I think a lot has changed. Even the conversation nowadays about menopause and people, it seems to be in the news everywhere about menopause. And I don't think that's a bad thing because it is actually increasing awareness. So
yeah,
increasing awareness is great, but I think we also need to change. For example, the way we work in a corporate setting hasn't changed in a very long time. And I think it has to, for the way that families are changing, and it has to change with us. So just allow people to be successful.
Interesting. Like, my current role is ways of working, product ways of working. And basically what you're saying is we need to change our ways of working.
Yeah.
Such that it caters for women of all needs, for the needs of single, married, with kids, no kids, looking after parents, like anything that it may be. And we just need to adapt how we work in the workplace.
Yeah, it's true. And one would say, oh, particularly in a lot of countries now, there's a quality in there's more equality than others. Not every country has this. Male partners are often helping out more. Women are making, they're still not 100%, but they are getting. But it's interesting. I'm a mother, and I was talking to my partner about working and working longer hours and having mother guilt, mom guilt. Even though my daughter's self-sufficient, and she doesn't care and all that kind of thing. And it's not something that he has. It's innate that's built into a lot of women. And I think that then, yeah, it changes. Even just the empathy that women have sometimes more around other colleagues, and it goes into the way, I think, way we work has to change to fit different needs of different people. And that's also too wide from a cultural perspective. It's not just women and men. It's people from different cultures as well bring different ways of looking at the same problem because of their experiences. So I think it's really important to have representation so that we can change the way of working.
Yeah, I like that as a very practical takeaway. Rather than just investing women, it's more of as someone working in fintech, listening to this podcast, you can go back home, back to the office and say, hey, how are my ways of working such that I am supporting not women, in general, but like the diversity of types of women that I have in the office.
Yeah.
And their circumstances, and how do we need to change internally to make it more, to make it better for them?
Exactly. Even little things when you're doing interviews, being aware of unconscious bias. Studies have been done. Many studies that actually people tend to hire people that are like them and look like them and that kind of thing. And if you look around your office, is that true? Yeah. One would argue it probably is.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I think we could have this very long conversation about women in tech. But let's move on to intakes and data. What is, because like data has become, data is very important, but I think we think about it 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was important within the tech community and that's it. Now it's become part, like core of the business because now everything is digital. We enable digital solutions based on customer behavior. And guess what? Data is behind all this, right? So what is your take on what's the role of transaction data in payments operations as such? So that we understand the context.
Well, it's interesting. As a marketeer, I try to stay away from the word data as much as possible. I have to use it. But I preface it as transaction data or payments data. Because data, I've realized, is a jargon word. It's a terminology in fintech. And actually, if you don't explain the type of data that you're talking about, it could be anything. That's why transaction data, so as I was mentioning, the thousands, actually billions and billions of transactions that are going in and out, it's about knowing where the bottlenecks are, what's keeping you from providing the best service to your customers and knowing that. So it's a being able to analyze it and take out the nuggets of information that's really going to make a difference. For example, in one of our customers, they implemented intakes and they had an 85% reduction in customer care calls. So that's great from a customer service perspective. That's great from a reputational perspective because you have less likely of losing a payment. So overall, you're having a better experience with your customers. So obviously from a revenue perspective and from an outcomes and reputational perspective, that's what a lot of banks want.
Yeah. So then can you expand on what are the benefits of basically tracing your real-time payments data flows, to have it everything in one single platform? If I am a fintech listening, I'm like, why should I work with you? What's the real benefit?
So there's two different ways of looking at this. So you can either track transactions that have completed. I sent my money through my bank. It went overseas to another country, it landed in my friend's bank account, and then they received it. So that's a completed transaction. Some reason, taxation or whatever it might be, I have to go back in history and I need to find the details of that transaction. Before, if I was to pull my bank up, it could take 7 to 10 days to track that transaction because they would have no idea what system it's in. Now it'll take seconds, literally seconds. So then, you're instead of having customer care queries that are taking 7 days, they're taking 30 seconds. Then from another perspective, we can track the transactions in real time. So I've sent something from my computer to my bank to say, I'm going to pay you in a different country. And it's going through all these different silos. And as we mentioned, it can get stuck. So in real time, there's flagging issues. There's alerts that come up. You can get additional data. Is it because it's going to another country? Am I sending it to, countries that are embargoed at the moment or sanctioned. On the front page of a newspaper sending, say they've sent millions and millions of whatever currency it is to a country that has sanctions against it. These payments are stopped before they go out.
Yes. And now that you talk about it, I was having a very similar conversation with people at work not that long ago. That it was like, hey, basically, as a product person, the question was like, hey, we have an issue with this specific field, but it doesn't happen that often. Do we invest the time in building a monitoring system that it can flag that this is not working or not? So basically, what you're doing is someone like me couldn't have to go and build the monitoring system to flag when this happens, but it's more like, given that you have access to all these streamline that data, transaction data.
Yeah, exactly. It's just there. It's easier. Think of all the transactions. Now, what we don't go deep down, so we can't say that this one transaction is anti-money laundering capabilities or whatever, but we partner with the people who do. because we have access to all the transactions. From a partner perspective, it's really valuable as well. We partner with FIS, one of our obviously largest fintechs in the world. And so again, we have the layer and then we can plug other people into it. Again, the people who are experts.
Yeah. So can you expand on that? Then you partner with the experts and then what do? They give us insights or what's
the partnership about? Well, a lot of times, so because we have access, it's a data layer that has access to all the transactions, but we don't necessarily go deep diving into anti-money laundering, fraudulent, all these different things, reg tech, meeting your compliance needs, your regulatory requirements, because then you would be everything to everybody, right? And it's not that kind of organization, but you can get them some, we can partner with those organizations that do. For example, there probably is a fintech out there that all they do is they monitor regulations for SEPA, for example, or instant payments or whatever it might be. And they flag to make sure that the banks are meeting their compliance requirements. But what they can do is by partnering to us, they can go through all of the transactions in a bank, not just the one in the silo. They can go through them all. So it opens up the possibilities.
That is powerful. Because then you have, like you say, it's not just the siloed data. It's you have all of the data.
Exactly.
And then you have each of the partners using all of the data.
Exactly. And that's the one thing from a fintech perspective that I think doesn't happen enough is that there's not enough partnerships within fintechs, because I think that there's a lot of competition for our customers' attention. There's only so many tier one and tier two banks. A lot of fintechs trying to get in front of these people, but actually it's not, it might be competition for their time. Actually, if you 1 + 1 = 3 from a partnership perspective within the fintech community.
Yeah, especially when it comes to B2B fintechs.
Yes.
That provide all these solutions where their customers could be either the large banks or even the fintechs themselves as such, the B2C fintechs, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And actually, we need to learn to work together and partner. Yeah, I'm sure there's overlap in terms of some of the solutions and the outcomes. But actually, if you look at what someone's core capabilities are, by partnering together, we could provide so many more opportunities and benefits to these banks. And then hopefully convince them of the fact that these fintechs are better, more cost-efficient, more reliable solution than building it in-house.
You read my mind, because that's the next question, right? Because a lot of people reach out to me sometimes on LinkedIn and it's, oh, we're so and can you have 5 minutes? And then we talk. And as part of talking with another B2B partner, then of course, the question is always going to be, how much does it cost? And the second question is, oh, should we build this in-house instead? Why go with them? So can you expand again? Why should we use someone like Intix instead of building the thing in-house?
Because this is what we do every day. We've lived it and breathed it. We are in some of the biggest, most reputable banks in the world. And so we know what we're doing. We have customers who have tried to build it themselves and they failed. It didn't work. It went on for years. There was a money pit. And then Intix came in, do what they do, and they implemented it and went off you go. So there are proven track records of if you're building something that you're not necessarily an expert in, there's a high probability that it's not going to work as well. Whereas you get the experts in, who can teach you and show you the tricks and the best usage and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and save you the time.
Exactly.
As well. Yeah, because building in-house is never as simple.
Because you have to learn as you go. You're learning the mistakes. And if you're working with an external party who has already learned their mistakes, then you're going to be further down the ride.
Yeah, you just accelerate the growth. And That is very important these days, especially for the product teams.
But it's funny that there is this hesitation from a bank's perspective of bringing an external party on within their systems and the security behind that. And I think there is that wall. It's definitely getting better. And you can see that by just the number of fintechs that are out there, B2B fintechs that are working with large banks. But I think some more than others are open to external expertise.
That is interesting because it sounds even a little bit alien to me, because what I'm noticing, it's a little bit of mindset. If you work in a B2C fintech versus if you work in a big bank, I'm like, why could there be any hesitation? Like, it's so much pain to build in-house. It's so much work. So many things can go wrong. We're not the experts. They are. Let's go and bring them. Of course, we need to justify the business case, but if we're going to do this, it's likely easier, better, faster to do it with a partner than building in-house. But it seems like I'm getting the impression that a big traditional bank, there's still some resistance to that mindset.
Yeah. I don't know where that comes from. Like I said, it could be a security thing. It could be, I think you're right. I think that if you look at some of the digital banks that are not on the high streets, they're revolutionizing the finance sector for consumers. And they can have a completely different way of doing business. So, yeah. Ultimately, I guess time will tell the winners and losers in that race.
Exactly. So just building on this and talking about partnerships, you just announced a partnership a few weeks ago with Clearstream.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so this was really exciting from both of our perspective. And actually, we just spent a morning at their office. And essentially, Clearstream is on a trajectory to innovate and to really have an evolution of their tech systems and the way they're doing business. And this is one organization that is at the forefront and they are choosing the best systems for them and their customers and their outcomes. They have chosen Intex, as I mentioned before, as the mechanism to keep track and analyze all of their transactions in the organization, throughout the organization. And it's been a really great partnership because they're very happy, obviously, with this innovation. And we're very happy to be able to partner with them and help them on this road of evolutionizing their tech systems.
Awesome. It will be very interesting to see, okay, you just announced a partnership, let's say in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, to say, hey, and actually, this is how the partnership went. This is how we
exactly and the impact on the business
and the impact. Could be super cool to see.
Again, we've worked with them previously, but we're actually expanding the region that we're working with them now. So we're working in their head office in Frankfurt as well, and they've seen a real impact on their customer service levels based on this, amongst efficiencies and cost effectiveness and operational levels as well. But you're right, time will tell. But it's really exciting to be on an organization, like I said, who thinks so forward, has so forward thinking.
Definitely. Yes. So as we are getting closer towards the end of the episode, but I want to go back to you as a woman in fintech, rather than continuing more about data transaction, transactional data. Part of building a career or parting a business or building a business is going through a roller coaster of events, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of that is having resilience. And resilience is a fancy word for what is it that we do during the tough times? That resilience is the thing that keeps you going during the tough times. So throughout your career, what is that thing or those things that have helped you during the tough times?
It's been a lot. So I think at the beginning of my career, I thought that as you went through your career and got to a certain level of seniority, you have all the answers. And I've realized now that your gut instinct is a lot better. And I'm not saying you fake it till you make it, because I don't think that. But what I'm saying is that you are making decisions based on the years of experience you have, but they're not necessarily, you don't necessarily have all the answers. And I think it's about riding that, the ability to not know everything, and that actually sometimes experience, you've been through hard times before. So running a business, starting a business, cash flow issues, joining corporates, change of leadership, change of direction, new solutions. And you have to just be comfortable with change. And I think that's one of the things that has really helped me along the way, is that you never know. I'm a planner. I like to know what I'm doing. I like to know the direction I'm going. I can tell you that kind of thing. And I think that over time, you have to be comfortable with someone hitting you from the side and having to change directions. Yeah, I think it's resilience. Yeah. And I think it's having a thick skin. And I think that's, again, going back to women as being in women in the workplace. I'm thinking women, I think, take things a lot more personally. We're a lot more emotive. And sometimes things in the workplace that happen are not personal. And we just have to have a thick skin. So that's what I've learned as well. You have to embrace change. And yeah, make a decision with your gut.
Yeah, and I want to elaborate to build on the thick skin, because for some people, thick skin may sound as emotionless or detached from the business emotionally. But probably there is a healthy balance where we are engaged and we are emotionally attached in the right balance to the business, because that's what helps you drive, right? That's what helps you be the best person.
Your motivation.
Otherwise, you're just like detached. So it's more like go all in with your motivation and your engagement and drive that you have for the business. But when we have setbacks, it's a, oh, don't take it personal. It was not you. It's just the thing.
And is that a genetic, not a genetic thing? Is that a gender thing? I don't know.
I don't know.
Or is it different personality types as well? Take things very personally. And you have to adopt, you're right. You have to bring your emotions and you have to bring your motivation to work at the same time. These are business decisions and not necessarily, you can't take them personally sometimes. It's a very difficult thing to navigate, I think. And I figured it out yet. I think I'm learning every single day and I'm reflective. I think the difference is I'm very reflective and I'm trying not to be so hard on myself. As it might, maybe in my beginning of my career, I would have been much more harder on myself. Maybe it's because I've seen some things before. But it is, yeah, it's a difficult road to navigate, that's for sure.
Yeah, I like that idea of being reflective. I'm quite reflective as well. And probably now what I do is, oh, I liked how I handled that. It was better than last time. That's it. Part of being,
which is
reflective,
better than not also liking how you handled it.
Yeah, exactly. Or even part of being reflective is also the saying like, hey, well done, pat on the back. It was a tough situation and you did a good job. That's also good. So talking about resilience and tough times, then what has been one of your biggest lessons in your career or entrepreneurial journey?
I think it's really important when you are working with people and you're leading a team, you're leading a company, that the most important asset is the people within the organization. It's the most expensive asset, but there's a reason that it's the most expensive asset. And I think that's something at the beginning of my career, I don't think I really understood, as you come in at the bottom when you're working your way up. But I've really realized how the culture of an organization, the way employees are treated, and it's not talking about whether there's a pool table or not. It's not, it has nothing to do with that. It's about, again, I'm going to go back to the very beginning. It's about the trust organizations have in their people. It's about camaraderie. It's about who is able to give ideas in the direction of the organization. Are we all in this together? And I think that's something that I find is very important in the teams that I lead. So I like to create teams that are, I always call it a team of experts. I've been around a long time and I've seen a lot of things, but I'm not an expert in everything. And I don't care if you're just a graduate out of school, you probably know something more than me in a particular subject. And so in the teams that I lead, I want people to stand up for their particular area of expertise or their functional area of expertise and own it, so that then we get the best out of everybody.
Yeah, I like that approach. Good. So then as we round up, there is one last question that I love asking to everyone. So if there was one thing, just one thing that you could change in the industry that could have the most impact for customers, staff, and shareholders, what could that be?
I think it would be partnerships. I think there would be more organizations working together toward the common good than seeing each other as competition. As I said, there are obviously some capabilities that overlap, but if more and more organizations in the fintech world got together and actually 1 + 1 would be 3, and I think customers and consumers at the end of the day would win from this, because there's so many different organizations out there providing so many solutions, actually it's hard to find them all and how they all fit together.
I love that as a theme, even that it's, you have amazing fintechs doing amazing things. What happens if we align and we collaborate and we build partnerships such that we build better together rather than in competition? I love that. That's a beautiful message towards the end of the episode. Thank you, Tina. It's been a pleasure having you in the show.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this. It was really a really fun conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. Thank you, everyone. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.